Well, this report is a bit unusual for Human Rights Watch, as we do not deal with one particular human rights issue as a standalone issue. But what we did is we looked at 5 years of the reign of King Abdullah, who became king in August 2005, and many Saudis, and indeed many foreign countries, also see in him a reforming force to bring this kingdom out of its stagnation in terms of social progress into the modern era. And we looked at exactly what it is that these reforms have done. And interestingly, some human rights concerns are quite central to King Abdullah's reform program. He is indeed trying to make women more visible in the kingdom. As you know, in Saudi Arabia, women are strictly segregated from men and usually have to wear this black robe whenever they go out in public. We also looked at something that King Abdullah has been praised for abroad, and that is his interfaith dialogue initiative. He's trying to change the image of Saudi Arabia, which is known for its religious single-mindedness and hostility towards other religions, and embracing tolerance of religions. So these are two areas that we've looked at, and we've very much welcomed King Abdullah's initiatives. But what we said in the report was that for these initiatives to have any real meaning for the coming years for Saudi citizens, he needs to institutionalize them. It's not enough to have an idea, but that idea needs to be transformed into concrete policies, laws, and institutions.
So at the moment, the so-called reforms, it has only been words. Nothing has been implemented concrete.
Well, nothing is a bit too harsh, but indeed very little has been implemented. Let's take those two areas of women and religious freedom, let's call it. So on women, we found that the most daring, actual, on-the-ground, real reform was to allow women to stay in hotels alone. And that's not very much. But in the same time, women have become more prominent. He has appointed a woman as a minister for the first time. But, you know, that's a symbolic act that gives women hope but doesn't change the situation of women without other changes. The kingdom has promised to the United Nations that it would abolish a system that is called the male guardianship system, a system whereby women cannot take decisions over their own lives to buy a piece of property, to open a bank account, sometimes to get health care, to work, to study, and so on, without the permission of their male relatives. So they've said they would stop that, but they haven't actually done it. So I have a case that I cite in the report of a woman who needed to get an operation, but her husband was in jail, so she couldn't go. You know, these kind of things happen, still happen in the kingdom.
Is that the law that, because the report mentioned that the women have the status of minors, so as same status of children, they cannot decide anything, or not much yourself, like you just mentioned. But is that a law, or on what basis is this?
The law is always a very difficult thing in Saudi Arabia, because there are very few laws, and the whole system functions on an interpretation of Islamic law and Islamic religious precepts. Very few of that is written down into laws, codified, let's say. So when I say this is a system, it is a system of a mixture of practice and law. Some of that practice, actually, Saudi women's rights activists draw on Islam to say this is tribal custom. This has nothing to do with Islam, and under Islam, we women should be free to do our own thing. And so the male judges and the male policymakers are accused of upholding a tribal patriarchal system rather than upholding the true Islam. So that's another fine line of distinction there.
So how are these courts working then? You say there's not much law, and you have the religious laws. I presume that, decisions or fines or penalties or punishments are ruled by courts and not by clerics immediately, or how does that system work when you get punished
system.
And go to jail? It's a court that decides it, I presume.
The justice system is a third area of reform we looked at, besides women's rights and religious freedom, and in the court system, what you have is religious clerics functioning as judges in regular courts. So you do also have that overlap between religious systems and the court system. Now, for somebody who goes to prison for a crime he or she has committed, this is solely within the discretion of the judge. So there is no written law in Saudi Arabia that tells you that stealing a car is a crime, or indeed that missing one of the five prayers is a crime. This is an interpretation of Islamic religious precepts, sometimes law, that is up to each judge himself to do. The state will not tell you what is a crime and what is not a crime, which is why some judges have jailed, let's say, people for witchcraft, whereas other people say, well, you know, it doesn't really exist, so we won't do that.
Because that sounds to me, I read that, that sounds to me that's not even something Islamic, witchcraft. I mean, or is it?
Well, the fight against devils and jinn and witchcraft has some roots in some Islamic treaties, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, the big problem is that it's not written down, and that there's no rules of precedent that cannot rely on something. And when you see over the past 5 or 10 years, the growth of the legal profession is dramatic. There are many more lawyers now. The lawyers study statutory law, so what we would think of normal law. They also study religious law, but to a lesser degree. And these lawyers, they want to go to court and they want to argue with the law, but sometimes in the criminal cases, they can't. So there is written law for, let's say, commercial transactions, or let's say how to moor your yacht in the Jeddah Harbor. That is regulated by written law. But when it comes to criminal law, that is not written down.
Except apart from law and so on and women's rights. Did you look also at the social economic situation of Saudi Arabia? There's also a lot of trouble. And despite the income of the oil money pouring the country in, but also did you look at the human rights of people, migrant workers who work there in a situation of, so to speak, slavery?
Well, when it comes to the migrant workers, we have to, and actually that's the same topic that we dealt with in the report on Kuwait, we have to bear in mind that the Gulf countries, so that's Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, and Saudi Arabia, that they rely to a very large degree for all of their labor on expatriate labor. A lot of that comes from Asian countries, some of it comes from Arab countries, but let's take the domestic work sector. That's the sector of women working, almost all women, working in households to clean, to cook, to take care of babies. In Saudi Arabia, there are about 1.5 to 2 million such women working from Indonesia, the Philippines, and other Asian countries. In Kuwait, we found 660,000 such workers there. And they all suffer from various systems that keep them, when things go badly, into a state of servitude where they cannot actually change their situation. It's called the sponsorship system, prevalent in those countries, whereby you need a local national to sponsor you in order to be able to live there and work there. And the problem is that you cannot go to another sponsor of your own will. So that sponsor holds a lot of power over you. In Saudi Arabia, if you're a foreign worker there, you cannot even leave the country, because to leave the country, you need an exit visa. You do not get the exit visa without the signature of your sponsor. And that sponsor may say, well, I'll sell you my signature for 1,000 rial, $300. So that's the kind of way that things are being exploited. Or what we see is that migrant workers often are not paid, and when they're not paid, they don't have a way to complain because the sponsor has so much power over them. The sponsor can cancel the work contract, and then the person goes into the deportation center and has to go home right away.
Is that situation the same or similar for all the countries in the Gulf area, I would say?
There are some variations. For example, in Kuwait, escaping, what they call it, or running away from an abusive employer is a crime. Let's say you're working for somebody in a household or in a factory, and that person doesn't pay you, makes you work 14, 15, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you just, after a while, you've had it. You can't take it anymore. So you run away, either looking for new work or just hoping to go to your embassy to go home. You have committed a crime as soon as you run away. That's Kuwait. In Saudi Arabia, for example, as I mentioned, you cannot leave the country. You're physically not able to leave without that signature from your employer. So it varies, but the basic structure of the sponsor holding power over you is the same.
You back to Saudi Arabia, you also mentioned lack of religious freedom and the religious minorities. Which minorities are we talking about then?
There's often a lot of attention being paid to the fact that in Saudi Arabia there are no churches, which is true, that they're practicing any religion other than Islam publicly is forbidden, which is true. But I think sometimes we overlook the fact that the much more difficult aspect of religious freedom is that within Islam itself. There is a minority of Shia Muslims. The Muslims fall into two very broad categories of Sunnis and Shia. Shia we have in Iran, southern part of Lebanon, large parts of Iraq, some parts of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Sunnis are pretty much everywhere else. The Sunnis are the majority, but the Shia are a minority in the world and also in Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia is particularly hostile to the Shias. They consider them sometimes not to even be Muslims, which means they cannot build their mosques, they cannot educate their children according to their beliefs, and there's wide social discrimination as well. So in terms of getting a job, the kind of friends you have, and of course there's no Shia minister. There was once a Shia ambassador. There are 150 members of the proto-parliament, the appointed parliament in Saudi Arabia. It's not elected, of course. And I think 3 of the 150 are Shia now. So not as much as they would be in population.
Again, on which basis is that discrimination done? Because if the Quran is the book for both the Sunni and Shia, right?
Well, the Sunnis and the Shias, they've had their differences over the centuries, and they don't like each other very much. It's sort of very much a battle for the true Islam. But why Saudi Arabia is particularly hostile compared to, let's say, Iraq or Kuwait, where for large parts there has been a living together or side by side of the two sects, is that the what we call Wahhabi Islam is the reform of Islam of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, a 18th century preacher who wanted to go back to the roots of Islam, who said we shouldn't take anything of the accretions to Islam over the centuries other than the Quran and the Sunnah. And for the Shia doctrine, it's important that the leader of the community has a lot of authority and power, and the Sunnis say that is contrary to the true Islam. For the Shia, their rituals involve celebrating the birthday of the Prophet, praying at the graves of some of the early leaders of Islam, and for the Wahhabi Sunnis, that is a heretic form of veneration. You should only venerate God. There's no God but God, is the Islamic credo. And so therefore, they believe these are syncretists, that these people worship more than God himself, and therefore are not Muslims.
Okay, so this is comparable to the religious wars we had in the 16th century?
Well, luckily enough, we're not at the point of wars, but we are still in Saudi Arabia at a point where Shia, because they are a minority, face a lot of discrimination. There is a Sunni minority in Iran, for example, and they're also not faring too well.
Oh. Does this reflect on the inter-country relationships, the attitude of Saudi versus Iran, towards Iran? Excuse me.
Well, we looked at the Saudi treatment of the Shia last year as well in a specific report just on that issue, and we found that the relations were as bad as ever, if not getting worse. So no sign of more tolerance or reform there. Mm-hmm. And some of that is certainly due to the heightened political tension that has been in the region between Sunnis and Shia, let's say since the 2006 war. Hezbollah of Lebanon, a Shia group in Lebanon, but because of the role it played in that war, it became very popular among many Sunnis as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then Iran is trying to, at least rhetorically, assume some leadership in the region, and that also leads to some people looking at the role of political Shia Islam as the more powerful, whereas the Sunnis, they acquiesce in Washington's demands. So all of that has led to more tension. In addition, there was a Sunni-Shia war with elements of religious sectarianism in Yemen that just stopped in February of this war. And all of this has led to more clashes between or more antagonism between Sunnis and Shia. And let's not forget, of course, what happened in Iraq since 2003.
Is there any pressure from abroad to change, to bring change in Saudi Arabia?
We often hear from Western diplomats that, yes, they are trying and so on. And the way to deal with Saudi human rights violations is through quiet diplomacy. I don't hear much of that quiet diplomacy, but more importantly, I don't see any of the results. While King Abdullah has, as we mentioned, engaged in some reforms, his reforms have remained largely symbolic. So whatever quiet diplomacy is going on, it has not led to any real improvements for the Saudi people. Saudi Arabia is a country that is an ally of Western states, European and America, and it's a very powerful country because, of course, it not only controls vast amounts of oil, but it's a very rich country where a lot of companies of the Western world want to do business, and they do very good business there indeed. So we have had very little public criticism and very little overall criticism of Saudi human rights practices compared, for example, with Iran, where every Western politician is happy to condemn the egregious human rights abuses that go on there. We don't hear anything towards Saudi Arabia.
How does the Arabic elite itself, the intellectuals, I mean, the criticists itself, the Arabic world, relate with this problem? Lack of democracy, lack of human rights, backwardness in education and so on. There was some years ago, there was a report on the whole of the Arabic world. How do they relate today?
There's a saying that every country has the opposition it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
And Saudi Arabia does not have a very active opposition either within the country or abroad. The Saudi government is very adept and successful and skillful in silencing dissenting voices, and not only by putting people in prison, that's part of it, but they also offer inducements, they appeal to the national or religious consciousness of people. They appeal to the fact, let's give us time, we're on the right path, we're a conservative society. So you don't have, either Saudis abroad or within the kingdom, very loud activists.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the growth of the human rights movement within Saudi Arabia over only the past 5 years is remarkable. 5 years ago, there were a handful of people who had ideas from human rights to democracy and so on, who were outspoken about those ideas. I'm not saying they were only a handful of people had those ideas, but who were outspoken about them. And today you have many more people who, at least on the internet, are able to express themselves quite freely about the kind of reforms they want to see. It's still in the infancy, I would say, but the growth itself has been remarkable.
Okay. Now, to close off, what report are you working on now?
Right now I'm looking at the same problem of migrant workers, but in Jordan. Jordan is close to the Gulf region, but not quite. Jordan is a country that has, over the past 2 years, put in place reforms that should do away with the sponsorship system and give the workers more freedom. So we're looking at whether we have a country that is a star of reform, or whether these reforms in Jordan.
There were also many Iraqis there, no? Refugees?
There are about 400,000 to 500,000 Iraqis.
Mm-hmm. So when will that be published, that report?
Well, we're working on it as soon as we can.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much, Christoph Wilke from Human Rights Watch. Have a good weekend.
Thank you too.
Okay, bye-bye.